I'm Dr. Megan Corrado, and welcome to Real Stories, a podcast that features the narratives of trauma survivors, professionals, and community leaders. Real Stories provides a platform for guests with diverse life experiences to voice and honor their unique narratives. During today's episode, we will be speaking with Dr. Sandra Bloom. Sandy, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Megan.
So tell us a little bit about who you are.
I am, by training professionally, I'm a psychiatrist, although I don't practice anymore. And I'm currently still working full-time as a associate professor of public health at the Dornsife School of Public Health at Drexel.
Okay.
So I teach a lot online, of course, now. Mm-hmm. And I'm the founder of what's come to be called the Sanctuary Model. And I have a new thing that's coming out that I'll tell you about later.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
What I do is I teach, and I teach about trauma studies, anything to do with trauma, adversity, abuse, all those really difficult topics that people need to know about and that most people have experienced in some way. That's what I teach other people about.
And are you teaching mainly in academia? Are you teaching people in the community? Is it a combination of all of those things?
I basically teach anybody that will listen to me.
Okay.
yeah, I teach academically. I teach undergrads and graduate students at Drexel. And then I do a lot of other presentations. So this week and next week, I'm going to be talking, just as an example, to Philly's the district attorney's office about trauma in girls and women. So because I have considerable expertise in this area, and it's become an area of real interest to a lot of other people, thankfully, I don't get any more many opportunities to really talk to regular people out in the community. Okay. I used to years ago when I was first getting started, but not so much anymore. Unless they're working in some pathway where I am doing that, like in the DA's office. I don't know who's going to be there, but you know, there will be a lot of different people there, I think, because it's available online.
Okay. So in general, right now, you're kind of providing support and training and resources to the providers who are working directly with the community.
Exactly.
Okay. And you're a pioneer in the trauma field. You've been doing this for a really long time, haven't you?
A really, really long time. Well, I've had my fair 3 score and 10, you know, so I'm kind of looking back at everything I've done. And I've been, doing trauma-informed work since the 1980s. I got together with some friends and we started a inpatient psychiatric unit. And about 5 years into that process, it was in a general hospital out in the Quaker town, about an hour north of here. And we discovered that most of the people we were working with who had a wide variety of mental health problems actually had been exposed to a lot of adversity in childhood. And it meant we had to change the way we did things radically. So by 1987, we were calling ourselves a sanctuary, a safe place for people to come to experience something about healing and recovery that we were just inventing, because we didn't know much about it. We had to learn all about that from our patients, because there was at the time there was very little research available, and very few people who were really practicing what has now become called a trauma-informed approaches. So yeah, it was wonderful. It was exciting. It was wonderful to see people who we didn't know how to help then figure out what to do to really be helpful to them. And that was wonderful. And I think that's what people experience now. And that's why I've become such a passionate teacher about this, because for all the caregivers, for all the helpers, really understanding this issue of trauma and adversity. Sorry, somebody's coming in my house. So my dog.
It's all right.
She has to check them out. It's my people coming, thankfully, to clean my house. Oh. When you live in your house 24/7, it's hard to manage it. It's like things keep moving around. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and you know you're the only one that moved it around.
I know I'm the only one. There's nobody else here. My dog didn't do it. So it's really, really hard.
So I'm curious, what led you all to use the name Sanctuary in this initial model that you developed?
Well, I got to think back on that. I think we knew that we were doing something that virtually nobody else was doing yet, mm-hmm. and that our emphasis was on what it takes to create a really safe place for people who feel scared and in danger all the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how it was, just thinking of words for that. What could a place be? Mm-hmm. And so in the definition of sanctuary, I didn't mean it so much religiously as, you know, like but in the same way that religions use sanctuary, it means a safe place where something sacred happens. Mm. And we knew we were really trying to figure out what it took to create a safe space for people to be in. Mm-hmm. And there was something really, yeah, the best word, it wasn't within a religious context, but the best word I can think of is sacred. That it was, mm-hmm. it felt that we had their sacred trust that we wouldn't hurt them, and therefore we were really responsible to, mm-hmm. we had to figure out what that meant. What did it mean not to hurt them when we were dealing with people who were often extremely sensitive to any form of betrayal or mistrust. It just seemed like it was the right thing to call it, because, and also to make a real transition from standard inpatient psychiatric care to something different, because we wanted to, by the time we came to calling it that, we knew we wanted to specialize in that. So we wanted to attract people who at some level already knew that their earlier experiences had something to do with their current mental health dilemmas. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to have it be like a marker. Okay. Mm. Here, come here. If you think you've got these problems, come here and we'll try to do what we can to help.
Mm-hmm. So today there's so much work surrounding trauma-informed care, and trauma-informed care has become this buzzword, but it sounds like your work really was a departure from what was before. I'm curious to kind of know, what was it like before?
Yeah, it wasn't that huge a transition for us, because we had this unique opportunity to create our own psychiatric unit from scratch. There wasn't one in this hospital before that. So we could design it then to be what we thought at the time, before we understood about trauma, still to design it to be what we thought was good care. Mm. So that meant that we didn't have to lock people up. It was all open, voluntary unit. We didn't want to have locked doors. We didn't want it to be like what state hospitals were like at the time. We wanted people to have a sense that the open door was part of keeping safe, keeping everybody in the community safe was the responsibility of everybody, not just the staff. And the way I had learned to do that, because that's the way I learned in my training, that I worked at Temple. I went to school and did my training at Temple Hospital. And at the time, the inpatient unit was open and voluntary, as were most psychiatric units around the country, everywhere, so that people could admit themselves and then could leave and they could walk off if they needed to.
That's a big difference from how things are today.
Exactly. It's a huge difference, and not because the patients have changed. It's much more about how our systems have changed. So we could create an open unit. We didn't have to have locked doors. We could have it be physically attractive for people so that it was pretty. There were colors. There were pictures on the wall. And that was for the patients and for us to be in space that was attractive and that kind of visually portrayed healing rather than restriction. And then we could, because we could design it, we could incorporate, we wanted it to be short term. We didn't want people to be in a hospital for a long time. And in the early days, that meant anywhere from a week to 3 weeks. We pretty much didn't keep anybody longer than 3 weeks. And it was almost like a ritual passage. So there'd be a week for people to come in and get adapted to the system, a week to work intensively, and then a week to prepare to go back to their lives. So it's almost more like a retreat, a 3 week retreat. And in that time, because we had that kind of time, unlike today, we could really assess what was going on in people's lives. So there would be a psychiatric evaluation. There'd be a full psychological evaluation with full psychological testing, including Rorschachs and TATs and MMPIs. We could then that there'd be a social work assessment. There'd be a family assessment. There'd be a nursing assessment. And then we'd integrate that all together. What? Because we'd meet regularly at least twice a week as a whole team to really figure out, well, what are we doing with this person? What do they need? What haven't we done yet? And I know this is very meaningful to you. We could, at the time, have a lot of expressive therapies. And we
That's did. Amazing.
We had art therapy. We had every day, we had a full-time art therapist.
Wow.
We had a full-time psychodramatist. We had a full-time movement therapist. So they would do groups every day. And with that level of, so the person would see a psychiatrist, usually me in the beginning, every day for a therapy session. We used medications, but medications in those days were more as a help for therapy, not a substitute for it. So everybody would have a psychiatric eval and then have a session with me every day. Everybody would see another clinician every day, usually a social worker who would often work together. And then they'd definitely have a family assessment. And then they'd be in groups the whole rest of the day in expressive therapies groups and psychoeducational groups. So it was kind of more like going to school for a couple of weeks than it was just sitting there and twiddling your thumbs. And so that was already the way we thought inpatient psychiatric care should be. And then we learned about trauma and we learned about all of the things that we had learned that were wrong.
Now, did you learn that from books or did you learn that from the clients or patients you were treating?
The patients, because there really weren't any books yet. So So we had to learn that from them. And so we started questioning everything. It was like tossing everything you knew up in the air. And then when some things came down, they were still true. Mm-hmm. And other things came down and they were absolute bullshit. And so that was very challenging, because by the time we got there, I had started out my career when I was a teenager in college still as a mental health tech. So by the time we started understanding about trauma, I and my colleagues had been working with psychiatric patients for a long time. Mm. We thought we pretty much knew all of the really big stuff. And what we discovered was that, oh my God, we didn't know squat. Mm. So we had to become beginners again. And going into beginner mind is a different space than expert mind. Mm-hmm. And we had to listen carefully, and we had to collaborate with our patients instead of having a power-based authoritarian hierarchy. Mm-hmm. That didn't work. We had to really find out what was going on with mm-hmm. them, and where could we push them, and where should we not, and what could we expect from them, and what were their goals for treatment? You know, all kinds of collaborative efforts that we just didn't know how to really consistently do before that. We did it sometimes with some people, but we didn't realize that the practice really needed to be different.
It sounds like a really humbling experience for you all as clinicians, yeah. too.
It was. And it was, I think what made it possible was that we had each other. So we were all learning as professionals from different backgrounds at the same time. Mm. And so it didn't feel quite so humiliating. It was more like exciting. Mm.
And you were all in that together.
We were all in it together. And we were seeing these amazing things. So, you know, when you treat people with a different kind of respect, when you treat people who are designated as psychiatric patients. So psychiatric patients often come into the system already feeling like they're stupid and sick and crazy and, they just don't know anything. And so when you bring people into a setting like this and you say, okay, you're the expert about your life. Tell me about mm-hmm. it. Tell me what's happened to you. And you stop focusing on what's wrong with them, mm-hmm. then everything changes. It was amazing to watch the transformation from just that simple positional place that my pal Joe Fodorero put into words. I remember it in a team meeting we had when we were trying to figure out years later how we had changed in retrospect. He said, well, we've stopped caring, really. Mm-hmm. Finding out from people what's wrong with them. And we really have spent a lot more time finding out what's happened to them. And that's changed everything. Mm. And we all went, yeah, Joe, that's right. That's it. That captures it. Mm-hmm. And it's become a national slogan. And Joe usually doesn't get any credit.
I know. I've noticed that. Whenever I hear it, I always emphasize, you know, Joe Fodorero is the first person that said that, right?
He'll love that. He will totally love that. I can't tell you how many times I've heard about how he doesn't get
it. Right. There's been all different theories that have been credited with that. And I'm like, this is inaccurate. It was Joe.
Yes, it was Joe. And I wrote it down in 1994 as the first published place it was. Because I started writing because I had something to say. Mm. And I knew it was really important what we were discovering. So I wrote the first paper about it in 1994. And writing's really important because it's like this. It's, you know, back then it was just writing. Mm-hmm. Now we've got the internet. But it's always like sending a message out in a bottle. and you never know who's going to, in the sea of information, who's going to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so writing became really important.
So did you imagine, like, thinking back on that first paper in 1994, that things would kind of expand and grow in the way that they have now?
Absolutely not. I had no idea about paradigm shifts, you know, about how things can really change and that you can be an agent of change. I just had this inside feeling that I had to write this down, that I had a responsibility, that I was learning things, that it was shocking because we were out in the middle of really what because I grew up in Philly, I perceived being out there in the suburbs kind of nowhere. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the suburbs, but closer in this part of the city. And I just felt, wow, this is, I don't know what we're doing out here. We're just this little tiny inpatient program, but we're discovering things that nobody's talking about. So I'm going to have to put it, I have a responsibility. Since this knowledge has been given to me, I have a responsibility to do something with it. And I had no idea what was, I hoped it would happen. I knew it was revolutionary. And by that time, I was clear enough because I was pretty active in college as a social, you know, a activist, that things had to change in a major way. And I started to see that if we could do this, if this could happen with the most severely injured people in our culture, then it could happen to everybody. Mm. And everybody could help to heal themselves and help to heal our very dysfunctional culture. Mm-hmm. And so it started because for me as a feminist, I see the personal as political and vice versa. It started to have political meaning for me as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's switch gears for a little bit. So we know that every individual, every community, every system has a story, and every story includes both adversity and strength. Can you talk to us about some of the adversities that you faced?
Yeah. I, looking back, because, you know, when you're in your 70s, that's pretty much what you do is look back. I have been extremely fortunate. Both my parents came from broken homes, and so they were pretty determined to not have a broken home. Mm. And they were together for 65 years.
Oh, wow.
My mom grew up, I think, with a lot of poverty. Her father had abandoned her mother and her. And my dad, they were both from a working class, edging into lower middle class backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was from a longstanding Philadelphia Quaker family.
Okay.
In Frankfort. And my father grew up all over Philly, and his mother had left the family. And so he was really raised by his father and his grandmother. And my mom ended up being a glass half empty person. And my dad was a glass half full person. My mom lived to be 90. My dad lived to be 102.
Wow.
And for the last 10 years of his life, he lived with me. And he was amazing because he would look back on his life and go, you know, even when bad things happen, I can see now how they all turned out for the good. He was that kind of person. Very gregarious. And he worked for the Philadelphia School District for 40 years, his whole life before he retired, as a photographer. So he went around all over the city making movies and doing projects for teachers in the Philadelphia school system. And my mom worked as a bookkeeper in a tag manufacturing company in Kensington. And then they moved when I was only three, they, because both of them were working, I think, they had enough money to buy a little house out in the suburbs, which were just in the 1950s, were just beginning to develop after the war. And it was an amazing place to grow up, I understand now, because it was a small town, basically, and a volunteer fire company, volunteer library, volunteer everything. I went with the same kids from nursery school all the way through high school, the same schools, and they were really, I got a really good education, and it was, you know, all people who were in the middle class. Nobody had a lot of money, and nobody was poor. It was, and then what I know now is that it was a remarkably safe childhood. I just had no exposure at all to violence or insecurity or, as we define it, childhood adversity. I was protected. The only adversity I encountered was that I had 5 surgeries before I was 10. Wow. And that's probably what aimed me towards medicine, because I loved my doctors and my parents buffered me. And I think I learned how to, I think that was the beginning probably of learning how to manage other people's anxiety, because my mom was a really anxious person. And, but it was not traumatic for me. I was really protected, and they were able to stay with me in the hospital. And it was 3 surgeries on my eyes and then tonsils and then acute appendicitis. So, you know, that's the only thing that I can say in childhood was adversity. So that's what I mean by being incredibly lucky. Then I got into adolescence, and that's a different story, because I started having serious problems with my parents. It was like they were the best parents possible for a child, and I was an only child. But when I started to really carve out my own independence, they had really problems. I think my mom was terrified that I would end up pregnant. And so she, when I, you know, love, you know, it's what happens in adolescence. It's normal. And the first time I fell in love, she became like a different person. I mean, it was really like being with a different person. She was really pretty abusive, and emotionally, not physically. And I think that laid the groundwork for me to understand dissociation later in life.
That must have been really intense.
It was so intense. It was like being, that was like 2 years of doing Romeo and Juliet. You know, it was awful. It was just awful. And was my first experience with betrayal of trust. That's what it felt like for me. And I got really derailed as a result. Psychologically, I think it took me a long time and a considerable amount of psychotherapy to heal from all that. And that taught me about the importance of adolescence, which we often forget. You know, that the whole brain reorganizes in adolescence, and you can really derail somebody who's had a healthy, good childhood if you don't continue to help them developmentally through adolescence. Mm-hmm. So what helped me, I was lucky. So there are turning points in life. And I think for me, a turning point was that rather than sit with all this anger that I felt and, you know, get in trouble with boys and, you know, hang out with problem people as a kid. And we didn't have that accessibility of drugs yet, but there certainly was alcohol. Mm-hmm. Instead of that, I decided to volunteer at a hospital, because I knew I wanted to go into medicine. by the time I was 10.
Wow, probably. Such an early age.
Yeah, it's because I think all that exposure in hospitals. And so I started volunteering at Temple Hospital because I could get there. My mom and dad both had to drive into the city every day, and my mother was heading over to Kensington, and so I could get a ride. And I became what was then called a candy striper, which is just a kid volunteer. I was probably, my first volunteer job was at Moss Rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. That's where I first met my first psychologist. And after that, it was always Temple. So that's really where I learned about racism. Before that, living in the all-white suburbs with people who were all of the same socioeconomic class as me. The most diversity at that time in my town was there was one Jewish family, and the son of that family, I went to his bar mitzvah. But other than that, everybody pretty much was white and initially Protestant, and then some Catholics started moving in. So there was, other than that, no diversity. So working at Temple, I started to meet mostly African-American people. It was later that I encountered the Latino community, but pretty much everybody living in the North Philadelphia neighborhood at the time were Black. And the civil rights movement had been in play and still was, but the extraordinary poverty that people lived in was pretty obvious. You just had to look around the neighborhood. The exposure to drugs and the level of violence was, I was seeing it in the ER. I would help the doctors. I remember holding somebody's head while the resident was sewing his scalp back on because he had been knifed. It was the first place I saw a dead person. I was very involved. I wasn't afraid. I look back at that child that I was, and I go, who was that person? Because now I'd be like totally freaked out, I think. But I was learning so much and so much about people. And there was a lot of care. There was kindness. I didn't see horrible stuff. I didn't see people mistreating each other once they came into hospital, into the ER. So, but I saw the conditions people were living in and what they were dealing with. And that was a revelation for a kid that grew up, white kid that grew up in the suburbs at 16. Mm. And then after 2 years of that, I had to start getting jobs that would earn money for college. And so I worked in the mailroom at the hospital. Then I worked typing up EKG reports. I remember a story from typing up EKG reports was at the desk where I sat. It was the cardiology department, and the desk was right in front of the elevator. And one day, the elevator opened, and this man, he was African-American, and he leaned down to get underneath the entrance of the elevator, and then stood up, and he was a giant man. And it turned out it was Wilt Chamberlain. And the head of cardiology was his doc. And it was just like, wow, look at that human. He's gigantic. By that time I knew I wanted to do psychiatry, and I made friends with some psychiatrists, and I got a job as a mental health tech on the psychiatric unit. And so all through college, I was spending every summer and every holiday at Temple Hospital. It became my second home. The people there that I worked with became my second family to get me through the rough period I was going through with my own parents. And my parents were basically my only family. And so, because they both came from, you know, very small and broken homes. So it was the way it could have gone a completely other direction. I could have been the kid that didn't have the good fortune to be able to do that and ended up on a very different track. But because I was able to go in that direction, I met all kinds of people who were supportive to me, who heard that I wanted to go to medical school, and there weren't very many women yet in medicine. And they encouraged me, and they'd take me to lunch and talk to me about medical school and how you get in. And they advised me, don't be a biology or a chemistry major in college, because college will be the last time you can get a wider education. And so I was a psychology major and a sociology minor, and I did a lot of literature and all the things that they advised me. So that was, you know, that was an incredibly important part of my story and what I learned. And then I did my, I went to medical school at Temple. And then I didn't apply anywhere else. I didn't want to go anywhere else. That was home. And then I continued and did my residency in psychiatry at Temple, because one of the person that then directed the inpatient psychiatric unit had become my mentor. He was my mentor when I was a mental health tech. And I learned about psychiatry first from him and from the people I worked with as a mental health tech, who were all from the community. They were all people who worked, that was their job, was to serve as a mental health tech on Temple's inpatient. And they lived nearby. So that was also how I became more aware of these radical differences in our culture. And did my residency, and then pretty much all of my patients were either Temple students, or they were from the community, from the African American community around North Philadelphia. So by the time I was finished my residency, I saw how possible it was. I learned a lot about power. I learned a lot about hierarchy. I learned a lot about how organizations function and dysfunction. I called him the chief. He was my mentor. His name was Roy Stern. And he had to constantly fight to keep his psychiatric unit to have open doors with the administration. They always wanted to lock people up. And so I learned how hard it is to keep freedom going. To really keep that sense of dignity going when it comes to psychiatric patients. So, and then by the time I was finished all that, I had been there, you know, how, what's it, for seven, like 12 years, more than a decade. I just went, the problems that exist here for the patients I'm treating have everything to do with poverty and racism. And I'm going to drown in this. There's no way I can going to be able to do anything about these problems. They're too big, too political. I got to get to some place where I can see that I'm making a difference. And that's how I ended up out in all white communities, out in northern, you know, Bucks County, was I could get a job as a baby psychiatrist, and I could learn how to treat people with people I was more like, and that I could understand in a different way, and that did not have to go up against the kind of adversity that I had been dealing with for so many years. And that's actually where I learned about trauma. was out
there.
So you
had already been working in the middle of trauma. Like you started off in exactly. Their ER, and then you didn't actually have a word to describe what you were seeing?
Nope.
Wow.
Nope. There was no language. There weren't textbooks. It wasn't identified yet as what trauma does. And remember, this goes back to the 1970s. I got out of my residency in 1978, and the diagnosis that we gave to Vietnam veterans of PTSD didn't even enter terminology until 1980. So there was nothing yet. There was some stuff that we know now from World War II and World War I, but there was nothing in what I had been taught or literature I had access to that referenced what now we call PTSD or complex PTSD. So no, the etiology of mental disorders was not clear. What caused it? What made somebody be born and then end up as an adult seriously depressed, suicidal, using drugs, psychotic? These all were considered kind of independent diagnoses, and we don't know where they come from, but this is what we call them based on the labeling system of the DSM.
So can you share, you've already kind of woven in some of the adversities that you faced along with some of the positive moments. Any additional positive moments in your story or turning points that you want to highlight?
Yeah. One person, and she doesn't come to me until 1980. She was, so 1980 was when we started our psychiatric unit. And in 1980, I also had an at-large outpatient practice. So a nurse I had worked with, a psychiatric nurse I had worked with at Temple, sent me her daughter, who was 18, who had accused a man on a college campus of having raped her. And when the police investigated, it hadn't happened. And so we admitted her to our psychiatric unit in order to do an assessment of what's going on. what this is a healthy, engaging, bright, young 18-year-old woman who suddenly accuses a man falsely of rape. What in the world is that about? So we admitted her. And I started treating her like I would anybody and started seeing her as an outpatient. And she was a delight to work with. You know, she was like your ideal psychotherapy case, I thought, at the time. And I saw her for several years, every week, while she finished college. And Joe and I worked with her mom and her sister. It was freely admitted at the time by the mom and the sister that their father, who had died prior to my patient entering treatment of diabetes, that he had been a batterer. But when I asked her if anything had happened to her, she denied it and said no. So, and I just believed her. And I knew nothing about domestic violence. There was no domestic violence training in those days. The first shelters weren't even created until the 70s. So I really hadn't learned anything. And so I just accepted that, okay, she was okay. So that didn't have anything to do with anything. Every now and then she'd be out on a date and she'd call me as an emergency and she'd have this little girl voice and I'd calm her down and then she'd say, okay, I'll see you at our next session. And next week I'd see her and I'd try to find out what had happened, and she would often distract me and change the subject. Well, 1985 comes. Now she's a graduate student in another city, and her mother calls me and says she needs to be admitted. She's using drugs. She had never used drugs before. She's suicidal. Can her mom bring her down? And yeah, mom brought her down. I walk in the room to do the psych eval, and that's the moment that changed my life, because she was sitting there, and this is somebody I've known now for 5 years.
And well, every week for 5 years.
Every week. Well, until she went to graduate school. So for a couple of years, every week. And here she is, and it's her, but it's not her. I was so striking that I remember going, oh shit, inside my head, and saying to her, who are you? And she gave her name that was her name. And I said, and how old are you? Because what was remarkable was about the way she was moving. She was not moving like her adult self. She was moving like a little, I don't have any words to describe it. And she said that when I asked how old she was, she said, I'm 7. And I went, oh, holy crap. This cannot be happening. And I knew what it was, but I never thought I would see somebody with a multiple personality, which is now called dissociative identity disorder. And so I started interacting with this child, what's now we call a child alter, who would go back and forth between being out, and then her adult self would come and talk to me, and the adult self had absolutely no understanding that she had this other part of herself. And so this was just amazing. And at the time, all we had we had video cameras. So we brought in a video camera, and I taped her as her child self and taped her as her adult self and began showing them to each other. Meantime, the child alter was telling me what had really happened to her as a child. So she had been, she was first raped by her father on her day of Holy Communion. And he continued to rape her for years. And she had watched him kill her dog in front of her as a threat. And she told all these horrible, horrible stories. And I just went, how is this possible that her adult self knows nothing about this? And as I watched them communicate with each other, I suggested they could communicate on the inside, and they did. And before she left the hospital, she had integrated as her adult self all of this horror that had happened to her as a kid. But it completely changed the direction of my life, because how could I possibly work with this person this long and never know this? How could it possibly have happened? And because I had access to her mom, I could confirm a lot of the details of her earlier life, so that my skepticism and, you know, concern about these being made up memories was erased, because her mom wasn't there for any of the horrors, but could confirm enough of the surrounding details to convince me that this was all very real. This was not made up.
Listening to this just reminds me of all the different multiple layers of experience that trauma survivors have. And also, I don't know. I just think about like an onion, something that peels back. You peel back a layer and there's another layer. And I think sometimes people try to oversimplify trauma treatment or the experiences of trauma survivors, when in actuality, you can know somebody for years and years and years, and they can have all these different coping strategies to be able to navigate through what they've been through. Some of the coping strategies may be positive, others may be negative, but just understanding that this process takes time and it's also really complex.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that's what we learned. And that it is of concern to me now that, you know, there's all kinds of checklists about what it means to be trauma-informed. Mm-hmm. And they're all important things, but it's that you just described. It's the complexity. And healing and recovery is much more like peeling an onion. And you keep going down through all these interconnected layers. And you have to, and at each layer, people may get worse before they get better, but that's not recidivism. You know, that's not actually getting worse. It's getting to the sore spots, and then having to heal from that sore spot and another sore spot. It's a completely different model of recovery.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know where this idea comes from. It might be from the medical model. It might be, I don't know, cultural ideas about progression and about growth. But for some reason, we think that growth is just this like upward trajectory, as opposed to it being, you know, like an ebb and flow, and things go up and they go down again. And that's all a part of the process of growth, is kind of this up and down, back and forth. And it doesn't mean we're not moving, but, you know, the movement and the growth and the progression might not look how we originally thought it would look.
Absolutely. I think of it, you know, when if you picture a tree that has been partially knocked over as from a storm, and now it's still growing, but it's growing in a completely different trajectory than the one it was previously on. And if you want to help that tree get back up and just be able to grow towards the light, you can't just jerk it up. And it's not going to be just one time. You have to brace it. You have to change the braces each time the movement occurs. You have to think about it in a completely different way. And that's what people don't get a chance to do now in our crazy mental health system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a whole nother story too. We could have a podcast just on like how our current mental health system does not promote like trauma-informed growth and recovery.
Absolutely.
So where do you see yourself in the future? What's your vision moving forward?
Yeah, well, yeah, I got a lot less future ahead than I do past behind. That's a guarantee. I think in the immediate future, I've created this with the support and help of Lakeside Global Institute and a colleague of mine named Sarah Yanasi. I've created this organizational approach that's going to be entirely online that's called Presence. And so that's going to come out within the next
presence,
couple weeks.
Presence, not like gifts, but presence as in being there.
No, like presence as in being present, right. So the future holds the release of that and finding out, does that, can we get organizations to take on learning this really difficult stuff, the material we've been talking about? So there's tracks for everybody, and then there's a track for leaders, for clinicians, for direct service, and for indirect service. So trying to have everybody integrate all of this knowledge, but for their own job, but then as a whole organization, how do you put all that together and ask, get people to think about and reflect on the really difficult questions and the difficult situations we're up against as a culture. Can that happen in a safe way if in an online environment? We'll see. I don't know yet. It has to get out in the world for me to know. So that's definitely part of my future. And then I'm working on I'm working very, very early stages of what I hope will eventually be a book about what in the world is wrong with the human species and how can we heal? Because obviously we're threatening all life on Earth, which we shouldn't be doing. So something's gone really wrong in the course of human development. And I'm really interested in figuring out what that is, kind of taking what we learned at an individual level and applying it all the way up to the whole species, because it's everywhere. These problems don't just exist in the United States. It's the whole world. So it's the whole species. So that I hope will be, I've begun already because of this retreat space that we're having.
Oh, that's a positive reframe. We're in a retreat.
Exactly. We're in a retreat. That's where I hope it's going to go. In the meantime, I'm still teaching. So I don't see any reason to stop teaching, really. I love it. I love the students. I think the young people that I teach are just amazing, and they need this knowledge. So it's a real privilege to be able to share it.
Any favorite or life-changing resources that you want to share with listeners?
Yeah, I would encourage people, if you're professionally trained, then I hope you will read my books, Creating, Destroying, and Restoring Sanctuary. And then everybody should read Johann Hari's Lost Connections. I think it's a wonderful book. I have all my students read it. They love it. It's very readable, probably more readable than my books. And it really gives an overall sense of how we've gone so wrong as human beings, and some really good examples of how we can fly right. And the other one, I would encourage people to look at a movie by Michael Moore called Where to Invade Next. Because we need good ideas. And it turns out what Michael does in this movie is he goes over and visits all different countries in Europe and in North Africa. And he shows how they have taken good ideas from the U.S. and applied them and are using them. And they need to bring them back here. So that's why he's invading. He wants to bring good ideas back here. And I think that's what we've gotten so prideful in the U.S. and often arrogant that we don't realize that there are other places where people are doing some really good things that need to be brought here, and that we need to be doing. And I would encourage people to become better educated, as I'm trying to get, about how can we change our economic system so it's not so inequitable? How are we going to do that? And Mary Trump's new book about her dad is worth reading. So those are the things that are on the top of my head.
And I would like to point out the fact that you have a gigantic library of all different types of resources, depending on what you want to learn about, too. I've had the pleasure of seeing it, looking at it in awe, and it's amazing. So you're always reading something.
Yeah. The website where all those will be available in the next couple of weeks will be called Creating Presence. And I want to say thanks for doing this, Megan, and thanks for everything that you do for CTIP. Make an ad for CTIP is a volunteer advocacy organization, CTIP.org. It stands for the Campaign for Trauma-Informed Policy and Practice. And it is Megan who created the website and who is our head of communications for obvious reasons. So I want to thank you for doing all this work to try to get the word out.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for listening to Real Stories. The resources referenced by today's guest speaker will be included in the episode description. For more information about me, Dr. Megan Corrado, and my work with the Stories Trauma Narrative Intervention, please visit my website, www.storiesguide.com. Also, feel free to follow my story social media pages on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Remember that for every story of trauma and adversity, there is always a story of strength and resilience.